This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy now and in the future. I'm your host, David Brett. And on today's show,
we investigate the effect of the pandemic on our lifestyles and investments. We look at whether or not our lifestyles have fundamentally changed.
So there's clearly kind of a pivot point where suddenly people can see that not just light at the end of the tunnel, but they can feel that light really getting close, clearing that and then seeing how has life really changed after all this drama is a whole other question entirely.
How to pick the winners and losers affected by our changing lifestyles.
So this is where it gets a bit more controversial, and many of the companies who have benefited from some of the lockdown trends would push back against what I'm about to say.
And the difficulties investors face after a vaccine-induced market rally.
We're having to look for slightly less obvious instances of companies that might benefit from the reopening, but also looking at some of those kind of lockdown winners that have been left behind since then.
For most of us, after more than a year in some form of lockdown, we all want to get back to doing some of the stuff that before 2020 we'd have considered normal. You know, like seeing friends, going to the shops, having a drink in a bar, or, whisper it, going on holiday. And yet, despite lockdown restrictions being eased, in certain parts of the world, there hasn't necessarily been the rush to return to normal. It got me thinking, will we ever fully return to our old lives? Or will the habits we've learned to live with over the past year, such as shopping online and eating and drinking at home, become the norm and our lifestyles change forever? In this show, we'll be chatting to Charles Summers. He's a fund manager and investor in changing lifestyles. We'll be talking about the habits that formed during the past year and the trends that will remain once we return to normal, whatever that looks like. We'll look at how that affects businesses and those that invest in them. But before we get into that, we're going to chat to Mark Ainsworth. He's head of Schroders Data Insights Unit. We're going to find out where we are in terms of the pandemic, the vaccine rollout, and how close we are to normality, and what it says about our changing lifestyles.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
It's been a rocky month for the COVID vaccine industry. In particular, the vaccines produced by Johnson & Johnson.
This morning, the FDA and CDC announced that out of an abundance of caution, we're recommending a pause in the use of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine due to reports of
and AstraZeneca.
The Prague, after a very in-depth analysis, has concluded that the reported cases of unusual blood clotting following vaccination with the AstraZeneca vaccine should be listed as possible side effects of the vaccine.
The AstraZeneca vaccine, it's become clear that it causes a rare kind of blood clot. It's called a thrombocytopenia. And this happens to people about 1 to 3 weeks after they've received the injection.
That's Mark Ainsworth. He's the head of the Data Insights Unit at Schroders. But he says while the risks seem real, they're extremely small.
It looks like, on the evidence so far, it creates a risk of death of about 1 in a million having received the vaccine. Now, this kind of blood clot is something that naturally occurs, so about 1 in 30,000 people each year suffer this sort of thing. But so it was quite hard for the authorities to disentangle whether this was something that just happened to happen after people got the vaccinations and it was unrelated, or whether it was actually caused by it. But it has become clear that this is although it's a very small risk, it is a real risk and it is caused by this. But I think just to put this in context, if you were to catch COVID-19 and you're aged 30, I think it's well understood that it's a very significant risk of dying of COVID if you're older. But if you're age 30, there's a 1 in 5,000 chance of you dying from the infection. So put in that context, a one in a million risk is very, very much lower.
And the data suggests that all vaccines, including AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson, work.
So all the evidence is that, that pretty much all the vaccines have a very, very high efficacy, you know, well into 90%, you know, prevention of hospitalisation, prevention of death. And that is, and it's actually really good compared to a lot of other vaccines. So, it works.
Our safety committee, the Pharmacovigilance and Risk Assessment Committee of the European Medicines Agency, has confirmed that the benefits of the AstraZeneca vaccine in preventing COVID-19 overall outweigh the risks of side effects. This vaccine has proven to be highly effective. It prevents severe disease and hospitalisation, and it is saving lives.
Yet countries have paused or stopped using AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson.
Yeah, this is the other big vaccine story of the day. It started when there were reports of severe blood clots in people in Austria who had received the vaccine. The initial reaction from Austria and some other countries was to just not administer the particular batch that those vaccines came from. But then today, Denmark said it was suspending all applications of AstraZeneca.
In many cases, the AstraZeneca vaccine is the only option for low and middle income countries. But the fragile confidence in the COVID-19 vaccine in Africa has been dealt a worrying blow by the European government's decision to suspend the AstraZeneca vaccine. That's affecting the rollout of a largely safe vaccine, which is combating a much more lethal virus and delaying a return to normal.
Clearly, every pause slows things down where authorities are sort of taking stock and evaluating. I think there are some places where it's going to cause quite big problems and general slowdowns in the rate of vaccination because of acceptance to the vaccines.
Which puts countries at risk of COVID variants evading the vaccines.
I mean, I think the UK and Israel, the version of the virus that's circulating is the UK variant, at B117. And all the evidence is, it's very clear from Israel, that the vaccine works against that variant. There is some evidence that it is less effective against those other variants that are mainly circulating, the one from South Africa and the one that's originating from Brazil, but they are still effective to some degree, especially when it comes to protecting against severe illness. So all the evidence is that the vaccines need to keep coming. And actually, quite recently, Moderna announced they're already producing a version of their vaccine that is tuned to these new variants. So this is a problem that you know, the world will rise to, I'm sure.
Yet despite the concerns, Mark says among those that have been offered the jabs, the uptake has been good.
So it's sort of steadily going upwards in various countries. I think UK is an interesting one to look at for a couple of reasons. One is that we've made a lot more progress in terms of offering a first jab to the population than the others. So that's one of the clearest ways of establishing quite what proportion of the population will be up for getting a vaccine. And another is because the UK has been exceptionally disciplined in working its way down through the ages, so starting with people over 85, then at the over 80s. And you know, if you look at the stats even a month ago, 90% of all over 70s have been vaccinated, so it's got to very high levels across those groups that have been offered it. I think the one key sort of wrinkle in all that is ethnic minority populations. So the uptake of the vaccine amongst that over 70s group among the black population is only about 70-75%. So that's a significant gap. And I think what I'd add there is, you know, some recent polling from Ipsos Mori, what they found was back in January, there was a very large proportion of ethnic minorities were quite reluctant to get the vaccine. But as of now, that's almost completely fallen away.
But while uptake of the vaccines have been impressive, we appear to be some way off herd immunity.
Well, so there have been a few places that, if you asked me 6 months ago, has anyone got to herd immunity? And there's a few places that I'd have mentioned, like the city of Manaus in Brazil, where studies estimated a very large proportion of the population had caught the virus and had developed immunity. And but in fact, Manaus is the origin of the one of those big variants that's now sweeping the world, the Brazilian one. And I think the key point is, Herd immunity is not a fixed number. It is a function of the way the population behave, and it's a function of the particular features of the virus. So these new variants tend to have a higher rate of transmission, a higher R0 number, as it's called. What that means is that they also have a higher herd immunity threshold, that the proportion of the population that need to be immune to stop the virus sort of growing. And that was very clearly seen in Manaus, which had a very significant second wave the latter part of last year. And so it is now probably at its sort of herd immunity level for that new variant. But it just really highlights that that is a dynamic thing. And it keeps shifting. Again, India, the whole of India, in some sense, it seemed to have reached a kind of equilibrium near its herd immunity level for the previous variant. But India is now seeing very significant increases in cases, and that's because the new variant is taking hold there and it has a fundamentally different herd immunity threshold. I think it's clear that there's positivity from seeing how UK and Israel and indeed places like Chile are managing to get large portions of the population vaccinated, and the clear evidence that that is controlling the spread of the virus. But it's also on, you know, there's not many countries that have got that far. Most countries haven't. And a lot of countries have been recently or are now facing into the total shift of that equilibrium caused by these new variants. So there's a lot of choppiness in that. And it does feel like it's going to be, you know, a good amount of time before international travel can resume. But I think increasingly there'll be a succession of countries that really do get on top of it, that the combination of the total number of people who've had the infection and just enough vaccinations on top of that, and that gets the virus under control, there'll be a lot of countries that go through that journey over the next few months. But there'll be several other countries where that process won't be completed until 2022, maybe not even 2023.
And yet, there are some signs of normality returning in certain parts of the world.
This is our only chance. We have to take it. We need calm.
Just a few weeks ago, the new monster movie Godzilla vs. Kong generated $120 million in box office sales over its opening weekend. It was the biggest global film debut since the COVID-19 pandemic began. More than half of that, $70 million, came from China, whose box office had already returned to pre-pandemic levels with the help of homegrown films. It suggests that cinema's obituary, which had been written during the pandemic, may have been premature. It's only a small nugget of evidence, but we are seeing signs of people's desire to go back to some of the old habits, despite changing lifestyles during the pandemic.
I think the key thing that's very clear is there's such a lot of pent-up demand to do all those things that have been put on hold. So one very specific example, we were looking at the app data we have, so we can see the sort of digital dust trail of people's activities. And in Israel, that's clearly one of the countries that's got closest to full resumption to normality, there's a very significant rise in use of certain travel booking apps like Skyscanner, starting from kind of about a month ago. So there's clearly kind of a pivot point where suddenly people can see that not just light at the end of the tunnel, but they can feel that light really getting close, and then suddenly start doing things like booking holidays. So I think there's a lot of that pent-up demand. I think clearing that and then seeing how has life really changed after all this drama is a whole other question entirely.
Which is the conundrum we'll be tackling in the second part of the show. Because a big change in lifestyle is largely what investors have been betting on as stock markets have surged over the last year. We're going to look at the habits and trends that have emerged since the vaccines were announced, and we'll try to understand what's driving lifestyle changes and which ones might be here to stay and which ones might not.
Get in touch with us by email at shorterspodcasts@shorters.com or visit our website shorters.com/theinvestordownload.
It's been about 6 months since vaccines were announced. In that time, stock markets have rallied as much as 30% in the case of the US S&P 500. That's according to data from Refinitiv.
From a stock market point of view, it's been quite a binary market.
That's Charles Summers. He's a fund manager and investor in Changing Lifestyles.
And what you've seen is the market basically allocating companies to one of two baskets. The lockdown basket, i.e. the companies that benefit from the lockdown, and then the reopening basket. And almost on a daily basis, you can see where the news flow is stronger. And the case in point and the date that really sticks in the mind is November the 9th.
Is it a game changer, or is it too early to be optimistic? The announcement by Pfizer yesterday was greeted with almost jubilation. After a year in which 50 million people worldwide have been infected and in which more than 1.2 million have died, it's easy to see why so many view this vaccine as an answer to their prayers.
Which was the date when the Pfizer-BioNTech major study was published and the efficacy was stunning and beat expectations. And that's the day where you really saw the reopening basket in the ascendancy.
This is good for 900 to 1,000 points on the Dow. We were up by more than 300, but now we're up by 1,300 points. Maybe not a surprise given how important this news is.
So I think that the rally is justifiable. I also think that we're going to start a new discussion, and the discussion is what's America going to look like post-COVID.
You saw companies that operated live entertainment up more than 20% on the day. And since then, a lot of the activity has been dominated by the news flow, positive and negative, around vaccines and around variants. And those two baskets of stocks duking it out over the last few months since that initial announcement.
But Charles says it won't be like a football game where the final whistle is blown and the pandemic is over.
There's going to be a huge amount of variation between the way countries come out of their various restrictions, depending on vaccination rates, depending on the spread of variants. And that's going to have a big impact on the way different industries perform in those countries. And we will see quite choppy data over the next few months. There's several factors involved. So different countries have different unemployment rates coming out of the pandemic. There's a huge variation in the level of savings that some consumers have accumulated. There's significant amounts of stimulus in some countries.
It's a once-in-a-generation investment in America, unlike anything we've seen or done since we built the internet. In fact, it's the largest American jobs investment since World War II. It'll create millions of jobs.
When restrictions are eased, in some countries, we're going to see that pent-up demand easily satisfied and lots of money to cover that pent-up demand. In others, it's going to be a little bit more difficult and economic conditions are going to be a little bit more straitened. So it's going to be very choppy data over the next few months. I mean, in some instances, we may see kind of euphoric demand and people talk about harking back to the roaring 20s when we came out of the Spanish flu in the last century. For several months, quarters and even years, there was a kind of euphoria amongst consumers and high levels of spending around experiences, whether it's alcohol consumption or travel or other forms of entertainment. And we will see those phenomena. We're having to look for slightly less obvious instances of companies that might benefit from the reopening, but also looking at some of those kind of lockdown winners that have been left behind since then. And going back to the overall philosophy around changing lifestyles, you know, several of our themes were accelerated by the pandemic. And we do think that some of those new habits are here to stay. So where we see companies that have been taking a back seat over the last few months with the reopening dynamic, we are beginning to see quite big opportunities emerging in those companies where those changes are going to be a little bit more durable. So what's really going to be useful for us as investors looking through that data and absorbing it and thinking about the implications for companies is having a framework. And we have our framework around changing lifestyles, the themes that are governing our long-term investment philosophy here. And those are experiences, accessibility, well-being, and identity. But overlaying that, one way that we're looking at the trends over the next few months, quarters, and years is this lens of habit formation.
As I said at the top of the show, despite lockdown being eased in England, I've yet to return to a bar or a restaurant, which for me, anyway, is strange. And it makes me wonder whether my lifestyle and priorities have changed permanently.
There's a kind of simplistic way of looking at habit formation, which is to say that once a habit is repeated a certain number of times, then that habit sticks. And if you look at the academic literature, it can take up to 254 days of repetition for a habit to stick. And clearly we've been in lockdown for over a year now in many geographies. And so you would expect those habits to have formulated by now. But there is a more nuanced view of habits, and that revolves around what's called by the academics the habit loop. And the habit loop consists of three stages. There's the cue, so the outside stimulus that prompts the habit. There's the behavior itself. And then there is the reward that comes from that behavior. And when we're thinking about which of the habits formed during lockdown might be pervasive, we're looking for where some of those cues and those rewards are going to be uninterrupted, but also for instances where those cues and the rewards are going to be interrupted. So an obvious example would be homeschooling. If there's certain parts of the day during a homeschooling experience which are prompting certain behaviors and habits, once that homeschooling reverts to normal in-person schooling, then clearly that cue is absent. And so it's less likely that habit is going to be triggered.
Which begs the question, which trends and habits might be here to stay?
You know, one thing that's being talked about very broadly is the acceleration in e-commerce, which falls under our accessibility trend. And depending on the country that you're looking at, e-commerce has been accelerated by 3, 5, or even 10 years in terms of those trend lines, a really significant shift forward. And it's quite probable that over the next few months, once people are let out of their homes, they're going to enjoy some of the social and experiential aspects of going to bricks and mortar retailers. So we do expect a rebound in bricks and mortar retailers. But in terms of those habits that have been formed around e-commerce, they should be durable. I mean, if you think about the cue, this is the need for food or the need for a non-food product. And it's almost a reflex now for many people to reach for the Amazon app when that queue arises. And obviously the reward that comes is the delivery of the item in a fairly prompt and predictable fashion. And those stimuli and that reward should remain in place.
Another lifestyle change accelerated by the pandemic has been working from home. Once frowned upon by senior management, has now become the norm for a lot of people. But is it another trend here to stay?
Amongst many workers, there's a desire to work from home more.
Andrew, I think it's mostly good news. I think the new data are suggesting that anywhere from 1 to 2 days a week are going to be remote or flexible for most companies. Obviously, that doesn't include manufacturing or some kinds of service. But we've known for a long time that flexibility is a benefit for motivation and productivity and retention, even before the pandemic. There's an experiment showing that when people were randomly assigned to work from home, they were about 13.5% more productive and half as likely to quit over the next 6 to 9 months.
Well, so it's very clear that people want to work from home more.
Mark Ainsworth.
So I saw a great survey published by Morgan Stanley where over 70% of Brits say they would like to work from home more in the future. And in various other European countries, it's sort of around about 60%. So very clear demand for that. And generally speaking, most people wanted to work from home 1 to 2 days a week. Quite a few people wanted to work three to four days a week. Clearly, the question is, when actually people are allowed to make their choices, is that sustainable? If it ends up being the case that the people who spend more time from home don't progress in their career, then the whole thing might come back to how it was. But personally, I'm very hopeful that we will be doing more of that. I think it's very civilized, and I think it's a real force for good in terms of things like gender equality. It really makes it easier to have a career and look after children, having that kind of flexibility. So I really hope that that is something that will be much more of a thing in the future.
And we shouldn't forget that employers are also incentivized in some senses to allow more work from home.
Charles Summers.
We saw the chairman of JP Morgan in his annual letter just recently talk about how he sees different job roles having different proportions of their time in the office and working from home. As many as 10% of the workforce may be allowed to work from home full time. And one of the other things he mentioned was that they expect to provide perhaps as few as 60 seats per 100 employees over the long term. And that's going to have a consequential benefit to real estate. And that's just one instance for JP Morgan. But you can see that the incentive is there around real estate costs. And we hear that from many of the companies that we talk to, that they will encourage work from home to the extent that it's compatible with driving the business forward and maintaining a company's culture. So with that long-term move to working from home, we do think that the emphasis on investing in the home is going to be maintained.
But perhaps not all lockdown trends are here to stay.
So this is where it gets a bit more controversial, and many of the companies who have benefited from some of the lockdown trends would push back against what I'm about to say. But there are a couple of areas, I think, where we may see a hiatus in growth and perhaps a drop in demand. So one of those that really springs to mind is scratch cooking. With the inability to go to restaurants, a lot of people got into cooking from scratch, and a lot of the companies providing the raw ingredients for scratch cooking and some of the other items for home meal solutions have benefited enormously during the pandemic period. And if you go back to the habit loop, what one might say is that, you know, the cue here is reaching the end of the working day at home, or reaching the end of the homeschooling day at home. The behavior is cooking a meal. The reward, more debatable. So one part of the reward is actually the satiety of eating the meal and the satisfaction of that. But also the satisfaction that comes from having made a delicious meal with one's own hand. And that aspect of the reward, the second part, the satisfaction of cooking for oneself, is not easily replicated. But many other aspects of the reward, and then particularly, you know, getting a delicious meal, is available very easily from restaurants and from fast food chains. And we do believe that there will be a reversion to prior habits around eating out once more of those chains are available. And of course, going back to the beginning of the habit loop, you can see from the way I described it that for many people who are back in the office or back in their other places of work, that trigger of the reaching the end of the working from home day or reaching the end of the homeschooling day is going to be absent in the future, or at least not as frequent. And so what you'll see is that whole aspect of that particular habit loop being removed. And so while many people will stick and enjoy the newfound habit of scratch cooking, I think it's going to be a habit that fades for a number of other people.
That's the flavour of the habits that were formed during lockdown and the changing lifestyles which may or may not be here to stay. But seeking out the investment rewards from changing lifestyles is another thing, and that's what we'll be looking at in the final part of the show. So investors have been placing bets on which companies will thrive and which ones will dive as the pandemic subsides. But finding the investment rewards from changing lifestyles isn't just about buying the next big tech company. A lot of winners might actually come from established companies that will adapt to the new world. So understanding how those long-term trends affect the way companies do business and how companies evolve is key to deciding which ones will be long-term winners and which ones will be long-term losers.
Yeah, this is where it gets really interesting, because the pandemic has accelerated several trends that were taking place already and several of the trends that we look at in our changing lifestyles framework. And there's some instances where those trends and the acceleration of them are going to bring big positive changes to business models, and some where it's going to be more debatable, the impact. And I'll just touch upon a couple of them. So one of the trends that we've already mentioned is the acceleration in e-commerce. And an area that is really controversial within e-commerce is food. And the reason why food is so controversial is if you think about the conventional model of obtaining one's groceries, it's really hard to imagine a better business model from the retailer's point of view, where the consumer goes into the store, pushes their cart around for half an hour or 45 minutes, in some instances checks out themselves, and then does the delivery part themselves by driving the groceries home. Essentially, the consumer is doing well north of half of the labor involved in that transaction. And any change to that, so picking the goods for the consumer or delivering them to their door, represents a huge increase of costs for the grocers. And the issue here is that grocery is a very thin margin business to begin with, often with only 3% operating margins. And so once you add additional labor to that equation, the economics become very tricky for the provider. And that's one of the reasons why grocery e-commerce has been very slow to take off in a number of markets. Essentially, the retailers have been the ones dragging their heels. And one catalyst for grocery e-commerce really flourishing was Amazon's acquisition of Whole Foods, which made it inevitable that the incumbents would have to adapt their businesses.
It's just such a game changer. And, Amazon to buy Whole Foods, you know, yesterday was a day for Kroger that was tough. Today will be an even tougher day. This is a game changer. This is it. This is what everybody thought could happen. They will now dominate food within the next 2 years.
And another, of course, is the pandemic, where in many countries we've seen e-commerce penetration within grocery jump from low single digits, 3-4%, to double digits, 12% in many markets, including the US. And that's a massive pull forward of demand. And the retailers have been scrambling like crazy to fill that demand. Now, in the short term, they've been able to cover the incremental costs because there's been a supply-demand imbalance. And so with many groceries in short supply and other items in short supply, the promotional environment, which is normally quite dominant in the way grocers sell goods, has been very quiet. So you've had a much lower penetration of promotions. And so that's provided the extra gross profit necessary to cover those incremental costs. But as conditions normalize, as supply normalizes, the promotional environment is likely to intensify again. And then those retailers will be left carrying the cost of the incremental labor that has to be injected into the system to pick goods from the shelves and to deliver those goods to the end consumer. And then so it's going to be quite a tricky period for many of the incumbents as they find their way through that equation and as they scramble to introduce automation into their supply chain to compensate and to remove some of that labor that is added to their overall margin profile. And we think that could be quite a tricky environment for many of those retailers over the short term. On the other side, there are businesses where the model has been profoundly improved by the trends that have been accelerated by the pandemic. So a case in point here would be for brands that have historically relied on wholesale partners to bring their goods to market. And you might think of sporting goods companies like Adidas and Nike, which have historically been very reliant on multi-brand retailers on the high street to get their goods in front of consumers. And what we've seen during the pandemic is a very significant increase in the use of e-commerce, but in particular, those companies' own e-commerce platforms. So going directly onto the brand's app and bypassing that middleman altogether. And as you can imagine, taking that middleman's margin out of the equation can have quite a profound impact on the economics for these brand owners, and it's really going to spur forward their margins and their returns. And as I've mentioned previously, you know, it turns out to be quite a good experience for the consumer getting a hold of their stuff this way. And that's the reason why we think that particular habit is very likely to stick.
So which companies are likely to benefit from these changing lifestyles?
There are companies, as I mentioned earlier, which are less obvious beneficiaries of reopening. And one of the areas we've looked at is around clothing and apparel. So you can imagine that once people are allowed to go out again, once people are allowed to party again, to travel again, that they're going to be more interested in dresses and going out shirts than they are in sweatpants and staying at home items. And so as we move to that phase, we think there's going to be a big surge of demand for clothing, fashionable clothing, but also for accessories. And one of the companies that we think is quite capable of exploiting that trend is Tapestry, which is the owner of Coach, Kate Spade and Stuart Weitzman. And there's certainly many other instances of companies where we think they have a good chance of benefiting from that less obvious second order effect of the reopening. Another area we like is home improvement. We've mentioned already how the working from home trend is likely to spur a more durable investment in the home. And we like companies where we see what we call a growth gap. So where we're looking for companies with unanticipated growth. We believe those companies are best positioned to prosper in the stock market. And one instance of a company that has been able so far to exploit this increased investment in the home is Lowe's, where there's also a recently appointed management team that has set in train a number of initiatives to really improve the performance of that company. And a third area I would emphasize is where existing trends have been accelerated. So we've mentioned e-commerce, and the poster child for e-commerce is obviously Amazon. People would think that Amazon has just kind of sat there over the last 12 months and allowed the demand to come from to come to them. But Amazon has been incredibly active over the last 12 months. They've expanded their US fulfillment center footprint by 50%, which is a colossal achievement during the pandemic, an incredible logistical exercise. And the company has also taken on 500,000 new workers around the world to satisfy this new demand. And so they've really accelerated their infrastructure and their investment in order to allow them to capitalize on the further increase in e-commerce that we anticipate. Another area which has been accelerated by the pandemic is gaming, which falls under our experiences theme. Gaming as an activity has been gaining steadily over time, and there's a clear experiential aspect to this and a social aspect to this, which has only accelerated during the pandemic. And many people have found their way of socializing via Fortnite and via Minecraft over the course of the pandemic when face-to-face interaction has been difficult. But one of the other things that's been accelerated is microtransactions. So this is where you open a lockbox or buy a skin. Many more people have become accustomed to doing that. And going back to the habit loop, you can see that the loop is quite likely to stay intact. So you have the cue, which is, you know, the need to differentiate in a game or encountering a certain stage in a game that prompts a purchase. You have the behavior, which is the purchase itself, and you have the reward, which is being able to differentiate oneself on the platform or being able to move forward in the game as a consequence of that microtransaction. And there are great examples of companies that can benefit from that greater familiarity with microtransactions like Nexon and Activision.
But that's for the future. What can we look forward to in the near term?
It's going to be a really interesting few months, both in terms of the data and how the stock market reacts to it. The data is going to be choppy. You're going to see pent-up demand coming through in areas that turn out not to be durable. You're going to see demand drop off in other areas that in turn rebound when things normalize somewhat. But it's really that framework that helps us to look through that choppy data and to be opportunistic, where we see companies that are trading at valuations that become very attractive because they've been left behind by a short-term trend, and also to take opportunities to maybe trim or sell positions in companies where those trends have been extrapolated too aggressively by the market.
Here's what else investors are talking about. At the start of the century, London began to challenge the supremacy of New York and Hong Kong. 2007 was a year of frenzied activity, which marked London's most successful year of floats. However, there is a danger that its zenith is now behind us. Peter Harrison, Schroders' chief executive, says he has become increasingly concerned that without reform, London faces slow decline at a time when Amsterdam and other markets are in the ascendancy. You can read the full story of why the city must back Chancellor Rishi Sunak's vision for the stock markets at schroders.com/insights, where you can read, watch and listen to much, much more. Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to get in touch with us about anything on the show or give us ideas for future shows, you can email us at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. If you want to listen to the Investor Downloads back catalogue, and why wouldn't you? You can go to schroders.com/the Investor Download or rate, review and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New shows are available every Thursday and every other Monday from 5 p.m. UK time. But above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.